You're listening to an encore edition of Studio Tulsa recorded earlier this year. Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. In a day and age when a phone can give you directions and a small device that sits in your dash can pinpoint your exact location, it seems as if the old-fashioned map could wind up with the likes of the horse and buggy, the typewriter, or a whole host of formerly indispensable items. But for many, maps remain cool, a vicarious way to travel or to reflect on our history in a unique way. My guest today writes about the history and stories of map making in his book On the Map, A Mind-Expanding Exploration of the Way the World Looks. It's published by Gotham Books. Simon Garfield is the author of a dozen books of nonfiction, including the New York Times bestseller Just My Type. And just as that book shared interesting stories about fonts and printing, On the Map does the same for map making. From the ancient world to incredibly detailed maps of the land and stars today, to maps that represent demographics, voting trends, consumerism, virtually any trend that happens in our world, to maps of imaginary places, as well as mapping the new frontiers, which today involves mapping the brain. Simon Garfield is the author of On the Map, and he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Simon Garfield, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Nice to be talking to you, Mitch.
You know, you can always divide the world into two types of people, and there are people who love maps and can almost travel vicariously through a map, and those that can't be bothered. Do you agree with that? And what is it about a map that transports some people?
Well, obviously, my friends are those who love maps and understand that. It's interesting. I would split that category up even further and say those who love maps and those who can read them and those who love maps and those who can't. And I would sort of put myself somewhere in the middle, really. There's something about the romance of maps that I think is sort of ingrained in our soul. I think it's we're sort of inquisitive, curious types. We need maps to get around. We need maps to sort of, you know, to find our way, to do the A to B part of life. But I think we also like maps because it shows us the possibilities of life, really. You know, the armchair map lover will sort of understand that even if they can't plan a great hiking trip or plan a great holiday or plan going to Antarctica or Peru, you can do it by map. And I think that's always been with us, really. And I think that's one of the things that we risk to lose if we just rely on our computer maps and our iPhone maps.
Well, you know, it's interesting, the whole phenomenon of computer maps, it's almost, well, you know, you also get the GPS devices. Yeah. Where we follow them blindly, it's almost like, you know, with a map, you're always looking at the terrain and coming back to the map. But with GPS and oftentimes computer maps, we'll just go to the spot. And I know here at this radio station for a while, Google Maps put us in the middle of a large field. And we would often get calls from the field saying, I'm here in the middle of a field. Where are you?
Well, I mean, perhaps we'll talk in a short while about how Google Maps is in comparison to Apple Maps. So, you know, that's a whole other story. But you're quite right. I mean, with GPS and, you know, all the new technology, it's fantastic in lots of ways. It's very, very direct. It's very quick. It gets us to where we want to be. It means we don't get lost. The problem with, and I found this because I'm a GPS user in my car, it's so much easier, especially if you're on your own and you're going to an unknown place, and you know, it's probably safer than bending over into the passenger seat to turn over a map. But you can get to one end of the country and maybe even across a continent without quite knowing how you got there and sort of what you saw on the way as well. You know, the risk is that you're just looking at a little plastic and glass box and that sort of plans your journey maybe 100 yards ahead each time, and you don't really notice what's around you. And it's the same when we're walking. The risk is that we don't really look up and around sort of anything like as much. And my theory is as well, I've got two kids. And their thinking, because they're absolutely of the computer age, their thinking is, well, you know, all this is fine. This is sort of all I need. And they hadn't I haven't actually tried this out on them yet, but I think they'd have great trouble opening up one of our great British, you know, Ordnance Survey maps and trying to find their way there. And you know, one sort of fears for a generation who maybe, as I said, you know, out on a hike and the GPS fails or the batteries on your phone fail, and then you have to find your way home. I think that's a skill that we might lose.
Yes, I think you're right on that. Well, let's take a little bit through the book on the map. You begin where maps began, and as far as we know, that probably was the Great Library at Alexandria. Is that right?
Yeah, that's the earliest indication that people were considering their place in the world, really. I mean, before then, there are some Babylonian tablets with a very rough idea of the world, you know, divided up really into three parts. But ancient Greece knew certainly about three continents. They knew about Europe and about Asia and about Africa. And what they also knew, really from sort of travelers' tales and people who had tried to sort of find new trade routes, was that it was a dangerous place. There was a great fearfulness on their maps. And there was a great sort of feeling that the earth is surrounded by water. If you go too far, you might get into trouble. What they did know, however, was that the world was sort of round or roundish. You know, this sort of myth that we needed Columbus to tell us that if you kept on going, you wouldn't fall off the end of the world. That wasn't true. And actually, you know, in 100 years BC, even 200 years BC, we knew that that wasn't the case. And gradually, at the Great Library of Alexandria, about 2,000 years ago, we developed what was quite a scientific method of looking at the world. We developed the grid system, for instance, and we knew where things roughly were in relation to each other. Now, it must be said that these old maps from 2,000 years ago don't exist, and what we have is essentially an atlas without the maps at the front. So what we have is the index. And we know what relates to what other places in the world. And then in the Victorian era, we managed to reconstruct this. And there's a nice image in the book of a sort of Victorian idea of what we knew in the world or how the world looked about 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, I was surprised to know that Eratosthenes in the 2nd century B.C. pretty much knew that the Earth was spherical, but he also had pretty much determined the size of the Earth as far as the dimensions.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, he was within 1,000 square miles, or square, 1,000
right.
miles.
A remarkable feat, and he did this in a way, and in a sort of very, very primitive form of triangulation, which is, you know, pretty much the way GPS works as well. You need sort of three points. He obviously used the sun and the shadows and where they fell. And he worked out, as I said, you know, what lay in relation to what. And from this, he sort of extrapolated a far sort of broader picture of the Earth and worked out the Earth's circumference. And it wasn't even regarded, I don't think, at the time as an extraordinary feat. It was just something that was a useful piece of information. Now we look at it kind of aghast, and we think, well, you know, how did he possibly calculate this? But at the time, you know, the idea of actually sort of crossing the world on a boat was something that they would never even dream of doing. And as I said, because they were quite kind of fearful of what they might find.
Now, you were talking earlier about myths surrounding maps. Another great myth of maps is the idea that unknown places in the world would automatically be a place of fantastical creatures, like the old famous line, "Here be dragons." As far as you can see, you haven't found a map, a real authentic map that has that phrase, right?
No, it is one of the great map myths, really, and the book has a few of them, and I'm sorry to be the bearer of bad news, but I'm quite happy to award a prize of some significance. If anyone can show me a map that actually has the phrase "Here be dragons" on it, scholars far greater than me in looking at mythical maps have actually located this to a novel at the beginning of the 20th century by Dorothy L. Sayers. And this was apparently the way that the phrase "Here be dragons" was popularized. That's not to say that people, you know, that sailors didn't see these fantastical sea creatures, many of which may not be around today. And that's not to say they weren't scared by them. And it's not to say that they didn't write on their maps, you know, and draw these wonderful pictures of these kind of ghastly beasts on their maps. But one thing they didn't do was actually write the phrase. But it does appear, we think, on a 15th century globe, which was made in Germany, and the phrase "Hic sunt Dracones" does appear on it. Now, some people will question that translation and think actually that Dracones isn't dragons, but it actually refers to a tribe called the Draconians, who were fearful in themselves. So, you know, it's one of the great things about maps, I think, that especially kind of old ancient maps, that they do have a kind of a mythical and slightly unknown quality to them. And in fact, it's a delight, I think, that, you know, we sort of get things wrong. You know, it's the nature of exploration and experimentation that we are going to make mistakes. We're going to see things that aren't there, say things that don't exist. And that sort of fuels our curiosity, I think.
My guest today is Simon Garfield, author of a dozen books of nonfiction. His latest book is titled On the Map, A Mind-Expanding Exploration of the Way the World Looks. And he joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Well, the oldest map you were able to see, and you devote a whole chapter to it, is a old map. I guess it's from the 11th or 12th century in England. It's called the Mappa Mundi at Hereford Cathedral. What is special about this map?
Well, it is the oldest existing largest map of the world that we know about. Now, you know, we talked earlier about a fairly scientific view that the ancient Greeks had of the world, and they tried to map things out as accurately as they could. What's wonderful about this map, which dates from about 1290 and is drawn on the back of a calf, or on a whole calf skin, is that he doesn't attempt to portray an accurate picture of the world at all. What it has instead is a Christian worldview. It's a view, really, of how one should live one's life. And we know this because it was used, really, as a spiritual guide to pilgrims. When they came to Hereford Cathedral, many of them couldn't read, but what they could see was these wonderful pictures and images and myths on this fantastic map. And Jerusalem, being a Christian map, is bang in the middle of it. And you find this a lot on medieval maps, that, you know, there was no attempt to sort of depict things geographically correctly at all. But what they had instead was great tales from the Bible and also some current news in 1290. So, they had news of the most recent king, for instance. They tried to plot out a way to live one's life, really. So you would begin at Hereford Cathedral and then you would travel on, and you would get, if you like, sort of brownie points for living your life in a correct way according to the map. Now, that's one reason why it's so fantastic and so fascinating, and I urge anyone who sort of goes to the English-Welsh borders on holiday to check this out at Hereford Cathedral. That's one great reason. But the other reason that I find it fascinating was because, despite the fact that it is clearly a priceless piece of cartographic history and also a fantastically valuable item, that the cathedral had a leaky roof in the late 1980s and were quite keen to see whether they could sell this map. And they alerted Sotheby's, and Sotheby's made great fanfare that they were going to sell this thing, until, of course, there was huge national outcry and the government got involved, and a very wealthy benefactor, John Paul Getty, came and said, no, listen, we're going to save this for the nation. So it was a very dark day in sort of car history when it was announced that this map was going to go on sale. Fortunately, all the outrage surrounding the possibility of this sale meant that a huge amount of more people now go and see it, because it created so much press interest. And I'm happy to say it's now housed in a special museum area of the cathedral.
You know, you bring up an interesting point with the Mappa Mundi, is that we think of maps as showing us how the lands lay, how the geography of the area, how to get from one point to another. But there is a whole other category of maps that tell us other sorts of information. In fact, you open your book with a map made of the world showing Facebook relationships and lines going to all Facebook friends. And as you would imagine, in Europe and North America, the lines just literally cover the continent. But maps can tell us all sorts of information. I think you spend a great deal of time on the famous tube map, which is not really it's a great distortion of what the tube lines actually look, but it's an absolutely priceless way to show how the tube system actually works. And maps can do that as well, where it's not realistic, but it does convey information. Important information.
Absolutely, absolutely right. Yes, I mean, the map that I use at the beginning of the book, which you mentioned, the Facebook map, is remarkable principally because it's not a map that was drawn by any one person or you know, geographic team. It was actually created inadvertently by all Facebook members. And actually what happened was that a bright intern in 2010 who worked at Facebook HQ wanted to sort of get a point of where all the members were and put this on his computer screen. And what he found was that the world sort of formed itself with all the links and all the friendships that the Facebook members had. At that time, there were only something like 500 million members rather than a billion now. And what happened was that the areas with a greater concentration of Facebook users were far lighter on the map. And areas which didn't have Facebook, like China, were dark. And so it's a map that drew itself. And it's something that sort of shows how far we've come technologically with maps. And it's also a map we couldn't have possibly have imagined seeing, even, I think, you know, 10 years ago. And the tube map that you mentioned, the wonderful London tube map, which is the map series that I collect, is an amazing thing because it was the first map that I used. So when I was a schoolboy in London, I used to travel the underground one stop. But in every carriage lived this map. And it was something that seemed sort of incredibly exotic. So when you're 10, you know, going to the end of a line, be it the Metropolitan line or the Piccadilly line, was as sort of exotic and impossible as the thought of going to Antarctica. So I got fascinated by this. But then I learned, and I didn't know, you know, I didn't quite realize it at the time, that even though this map has now been copied all over the world, it is very much, you know, one of the most inaccurate maps we'll ever use. It's diagrammatically, it's fascinating, and it tells you where to change and what, you know, what stop's going to come next. But actually, it distorts London a great deal. It suggests that every tube stop is the same mileage apart, whereas in fact, you know, some stops take about 30 seconds and some take about 4 minutes, and yet they're all placed, you know, exactly the same distance away. It also suggests that the centre of London is far less concentrated and confusing than it actually is. But as a piece of PR and a marketing exercise about how easy it is to get around a tube, which is in a way what it was intended to do, it was intended to encourage customers to find the tube far more easier and far more cleaner and lighter. And as such, it works its map trick.
But of course, distortions are a part of nearly all maps. And of course, you write about Gerardus Mercador. You know, when we look at a map of the world, unless we're looking at a specially designed map, you know, the Greenland distortion, which makes Greenland and Canada and the northern latitudes much larger than they are, we have a distorted view of the world just through maps.
Yeah, absolutely right. There's no such thing really as a kind of objective, true map. I mean, traditionally, maps were drawn with a purpose. You know, as I described the Mapamundi, that was a religious purpose. They often have a ingrained sort of political reasons for coming into being. They may be commissioned by a landowner who wanted to show perhaps more land than he really owned. Obviously, if we're talking about military maps, they have their own purpose. So maps are designed, by and large, with a particular aim in mind. And I think we should be very careful of judging a map as kind of true. I mean, we know from experience, just by walking around, now that would be London or Tulsa or wherever you are in the world, that one has a map, and be it an electronic map or a map that we fold in our hands, and we say, hang on a minute, you know, that cul-de-sac, that bit of road isn't actually there, or they haven't put that place on. So we know from personal experience that maps aren't accurate. But I talk in the book, you know, there are some wonderful examples of huge areas of the world that traditionally have been on maps, and incorrectly so, for 100 years. And, you know, the classic example is for about 200 years, California was shown as an island from the 17th century to a Japanese map in the 19th century. California exists as a sort of free-floating country. And this wasn't, you know, a sort of the old sort of crank catalog. So this was actually believed. I mean, the thing about maps, which a little bit harder to get away with now, is that once something was wrong, it was very hard to correct it. Once a map was printed in great amounts and then reprinted and then copied by other map makers, most map makers weren't travelers themselves, so they didn't go and check things out. And what they were interested in is producing beautiful maps and producing maps that their customers wanted to buy. And if things were a bit wrong, they didn't mind so much. And I often think of maps as a sort of, you know, the especially kind of early maps as having properties which you compare to Wikipedia in a way. So there would often be mistakes on Wikipedia, and hopefully these will be corrected fairly soon. But for a while, you know, every school child in the country will sort of copy something down from Wikipedia that might be wrong, and there will be a thousand school essays with the same mistake on it because it's been copied. And the same with maths, so which is why California, as I said, and there's a nice illustration of the book, you know, just in the book, just sort of a California floating free until someone actually, well, enough people tried to actually sail all the way around California and found that there were places like Nevada in the way.
My guest today, Simon Garfield, his new book is titled On the Map, A Mind-Expanding Exploration of the Way the World Looks, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I was reading something. I don't think it was in your book, but it was another book about maps, and it was you were talking about military maps earlier and made me think of this. You said that, you know, the dissemination of detailed maps of a place was a sign of civilization, because prior to times of war, that detailed information would be used against a country. The idea of a detailed city map that was actually accurate, or a detailed country map that was accurate. This was a sign of civilization, that these maps could actually be disseminated. Now I'm talking about, you know, more recent history, the last 200 years.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. But interestingly, we have to be careful what we mean by civilization in this sense. I mean, what it shows, of course, is sort of, you know, I suppose you could argue, well, it was, you know, maps depict a growing sort of, economic wealth. And obviously they would depict the spread of an economic center, and that would be, you know, a city or a country as a whole. But there were huge areas of the world where, maps as we understand them, either technological maps, you know, digital maps, or paper maps, simply aren't important, because they're sort of happy with their lot. They don't need to find out, A, you know, where they're going to travel, because maybe they don't travel. And if they want to get to a particular region, in 100 miles away, they would just sort of depict it by landmarks. They would draw something in the sand which had rivers and mountains, and they would have their own methods of getting around. And they would use tracking, and they would use the heavens to guide them, and old traditional ways. Now, it's only
I mean, if we use the American West as an example, you know, when Lewis and Clark set out at the beginning of the 1800s, you know, the people they encountered on the way, they didn't have any maps. I mean, America hadn't been mapped in that traditional way. And actually what they found was that, you know, they would send back their own new maps to Washington. But the way they would be guided to the West, both, you know, Lewis and Clark and their team, was by local natives who had a whole different way of mapping their country. And so, you know, it's sort of, we tend to think of maps as kind of, you know, road signs and landmarks in that way. But of course, if we look up at the heavens, that's a whole different way of mapping the world. And, you know, I talk a little bit as well in the book about sort of brain mapping, about how we try and understand, how we try and map things within ourselves and the anatomy of people. And that's fascinating as well, the whole development of that. And then I also, you know, I kind of, you know, I have fun in the book with digital maps. And I, as I said, I have a kind of love-hate relationship with them. But I think the most significant and exciting new forms of cartography are not in maps that we use in the real world, but are maps on computer games, and maps that imagine, you know, imaginary islands and imaginary continents in the way that, you know, J.R. Tolkien used to do.
The fantasy games, and things
exactly,
like that.
Exactly, fantasy games. And they've taken over, I think, very much from, you know, classic children's literature like The Hobbit and, you know, Alice in Wonderland and Treasure Island and all those books that had fantastic maps in them, and really, you know, I think for many children formed a love of maps in their heads, which haven't left. And I think that tradition is being now carried on into computer games.
You know, sounds like maps will never leave us, even though we have the GPS and Google.
Well, I hope not, because I think, you know, sort of maps are wonderful things, and I think, you know, one thing I really tried to do in the book was to show really how maps sort of tell out our history, and I think it'll be a great shame if we lose that ability.
Simon Garfield, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for joining us.
Great, Rich. It was really nice talking to you.
Simon Garfield speaking with us via Skype from Cornwall, England. His new book is titled On the Map, A Mind-Expanding Exploration of the Way the World Looks. It's published by Gotham Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent shows, they're available online at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa and look through our archives. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.